From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we go to Moscow to speak with geopolitical analyst Mark Sloboda about the recent release of a woman who's been referred to internationally as a hostage of U.S. business interests. Mark, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Don, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be with you on CPR.
And likewise. We're going to talk about Meng Wanzhou. Meng Wanzhou is the CFO of the largest telecommunications firm in the world, also one of the most advanced in terms of networks, since they are pretty much the only one capable of providing the new fifth generation's 5G service.
And they're already working on 6G.
Yeah, and they're well into it, from what I understand, too.
Yeah.
She was arrested in Canada by Dudley Do-Right and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And held on behalf of a treaty between the United States and Canada for extradition. Charges brought in the United States during the Trump administration apparently wire fraud, bank fraud, things having to do with a subsidiary corporation that allegedly had some sort of contact with business in Iran outside of the U.S. sanctions. I guess that's a summary of the case. If you want to correct me, please feel free. And let's chat about that.
Yeah. Meng Wanzhou, the chief financial officer of Huawei, which is the largest telecommunications company in the world, that the U.S. has been pressuring, has basically outlawed from doing anything related with 5G or, you know, anything related to it from the United States, and is pressuring all of its allies, Anglophone, Five Eyes, Cabal, the European countries, from doing business with Huawei.
Right.
Because, you know, particularly on 5G, it being the largest telecommunications company in the world and the only one able to do 5G installations on any scale, the only company really in the world at this point, which is, the demand that you not work with Huawei on 5G means you're going to be behind anyone who does work with Huawei on 5G by several years.
Right.
And the reason for the U.S. uses for this is national security reasons, right? Because it prevents a spying threat.
Let me just interrupt there on that, because in my opinion, very quickly, and I'm sorry to interrupt your train of thought, but if you think about the Chilean coup back in 1973 and some of the primary motivators there, one in particular was AT&T, which at the time, International Telephone and Telegraph, was the largest global telecommunications company in the world. And they were basically a primary engine of U.S. foreign policy at that point in time. That's how much power they wielded as the owner of the semi-global telephone network. What we're talking about here is a global wireless network, the most contemporary, the best, fastest technology that there is, and only this one company in a position to build out the world. So forgetting whether or not people can be listened to on that, the real reason is that the United States loses a real chunk of global power by having some other corporation get there, even if it's on the merits.
Yeah. Okay. So, first of all, of course, China's losing lots of money by this is on one level. This is surely a business,
right?
The U.S. is doing the same thing with Germany. It was trying to do the same thing over Nord Stream 2. You can't build a new pipeline with Russia, Germany.
Right.
We're dictating your energy security. You need to buy much more expensive American liquefied natural gas from us.
From
now, never mind that we're buying more Russian oil than ever, and Russia has since become the number two company or country that the U.S. imports oil from, which is kind of shocking.
It's funny too,
right after Mexico, right?
Right.
The U.S. is now number two, so as they're lecturing Germany, you know, and dictating their you know, foreign and energy security policy, or were trying to, they're buying more American or more Russian oil than ever.
Right.
So it's definitely a case of do as we say. That. So there's a business angle. And then there's also, you know, they say that China could spy on your communications. Well, whether no one has ever presented any evidence that, you know, that was being done with existing 5G networks, or even that you know, that Huawei had ever been caught doing that or anything of the sort. But the real loss here is that the U.S. already has, and we know this from the Snowden leaks and other WikiLeaks that reveal that the U.S. has complete control over telecommunications, has complete access, and regularly data mines and surveils
everyone. They're just spying on everybody. Right.
And through the global Five Eyes cabal, you know, the five Anglophone countries, the U.S., the U.K., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the agreement they have is they all have access to the telecommunications data from the undersea cables and so on that the U.S. collects from all over the world, you know, particularly on each other's countries. And they're not allowed to spy on their own citizens, not allowed to do mass surveillance, right, without warrants. And, you know, so what they do is they spy – they have an agreement that they spy on each other citizens and then share the information. Right. That is literally what it is. You can read about it yourself. And that is what would be primarily disrupted, because it would not be as easy for them to surveil, you know, the world, but more importantly, their own citizens.
Right.
And that's their big beef. That's one of their big, you know, there's always more than one reason for this. The economics angle, the geopolitics, the spying, that is why the U.S. is out to get Huawei.
All that sums up to, by the way, is that you add China to the BCC list at the bottom of the memo when you're sending out the data. That's basically all it means, is they're cutting them in on all the spying that everybody's doing on each other. You know, I just want to say one thing also. While we're talking about this battle between Western telecoms and Huawei, it's not as if we're talking about American jobs, because chances are any of the real jobs for this are going to be outsourced to China anyway. That's the irony. We're talking about who's fighting over the profits in the boardrooms.
I mean, at this point, as far as I understand it, California was outsourcing the construction of bridges to China and then shipping them back to shipping them back to California. To yeah. I mean, let's not even talk about 5G. We can just talk about bridges that we want to sell.
Right. It's so fun. It's not even. I mean, these things were. Yeah. You know. Yeah. Go ahead.
So you know, as part of their war against Huawei, as part of their war against China, during the Trump administration, supposedly spearheaded by John Bolton, they came up with these bull feces charges against Meng Wanzhao and kidnapped her. This is a political economic kidnapping, and no one should have any illusions. Anyway, the official charges were bank fraud, two cases of bank fraud, wire fraud, and conspiracy to commit bank and wire fraud. Oh, that sounds really serious. What is that all about? Okay, well, it's about illegal unilateral U.S. sanctions against Iran, right? Which not only have no basis under international law, but were not even being upheld in Canada. Or, you know, are not followed by the Canadian government, so it's not against the law in Canada. Or, of course, are they in China? And the official and Huawei was doing some middleman business there still with this, you know, with Iranian corporate entities that were under unilateral sanction. We're not talking, you know, the now ended UN weapon sanctions against Iran. We're talking the U.S. unilateral stuff.
Right.
That came about after they pulled out of the JCPOA unilaterally also. So she was giving a presentation to executives of HSBC, the British Standard International big bank that does a lot of nasty stuff, including with opium. That's all kept on the hush-hush because it's a good bank, right? It's a Western bank. So she was giving a presentation, and in the presentation on one of the slides, it listed a company as a local partner of Huawei in Iran, when in fact it was a local subsidiary. That was it. That is what she agreed to in the statements of fact, the agreements on fact, that finally allowed her to be released after 3 years in captivity. That's it. You know, it said local, again, you know, let's forget the legality of unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iranian companies. Let's just talk about what was agreed in the deferred prosecution agreement and the agreed upon statement of fact, that it said local partner, and it should have said local subsidiary on a PowerPoint projection that almost certainly she didn't even write herself, being a chief financial officer of a company. It's not even apparent that she actually said it. It was simply on a slide on a PowerPoint projection that she gave. And that is it. She pled in the court that finally released her, the Canadian court. She pled not guilty to all the charges against her, and all she agreed to was this simple statement of fact. And the Western press is proclaiming this as she agreed to wrongdoing.
Now, I just want to explain this little thing to the audience. This is some, you know, I have some considerable experience dealing with corporate forms. I spent 40 some odd years in, you know, real estate, finance, and et cetera. And what we're talking about is, let's say that I have a company in the United States. I incorporate in New York State, for example, manufacturing widgets, which is a fictional product. And I want to find some people in various countries that also will help me market them or maybe manufacture them, outsourcing some of the work, or help me get the materials needed to build them, whatever. So I'm going to go find someone who is in that business, say in England, in London. And I contact them, and we make a contract, and they set up a corporation to do this in London. So I have XYZ Widget Corp, or Don DeBar Widget Corp in New York. And so say we incorporate in London under the name Don DeBar Widget Corp -UK, you know, and then whatever corporate entity, you know, tag you put on it in that case. So suppose I own some percentage of the stock, or my corporation here owns some percentage of the stock there. Under New York law, you could consider that a subsidiary corporation in London. When I'm talking to people about the business that I'm in, I may very well say in a presentation on a screen, our London partner is, you know, Bob, who's the president of, or the, you know, main person behind this London operation. That's what she's accused of, is conflating the terminology in a PowerPoint presentation like that. And this is a person whose background before she went to work in communications as a CFO, which makes it sound like she's just an accountant, is actually someone that came from the real estate banking in China. If you know anything about that, you know that there's been more construction in China in the time that she was there than perhaps in half the history of the world. And so she's a pretty sophisticated player that understands some pretty deep stuff. And if you were ever in real estate finance in the United States, you would know that is probably the location of 50% of the most sophisticated business people in the world. So this is no dummy on the one hand. On the other hand, what she did is a ridiculous, ridiculous conflation, and that doesn't factor for language differences.
Yeah. And, you know, why did the U.S. specifically go after her to begin with? Well, they're going after Huawei. And she is not just the chief financial officer, but she was also the daughter of the founder of the company. It was seen as something personal as well.
She's Patty Hearst of the the business world.
And Trump made clear why this was all done when he, on multiple occasions, in both tweets and spoken, made clear that she could be released as part of a trade deal to end the U.S.-started trade war by Trump with China.
Trump being a real estate guy from Atlantic City where the mafia is, okay?
Yeah, they took her as a hostage, as blackmail.
He's right? Negotiating.
To try, that's his idea of negotiating. If we come to a trade deal, she can be released at the end of it. He made that perfectly clear. Yep. And in fact, and Canada was chosen because the U.S. knew that its courts – despite pretensions to the otherwise, were completely subservient to the U.S. and would uphold the U.S. extradition.
That's right. It's a mask that they could put on. We didn't do it.
It was Canada. And Canada went along with all this, and they paid the price because China then took two Canadian citizens. This was Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig into custody in China, saying that they were spies, right? That they were, they were there officially on other work. One of them a think tanker, the other one in business, but in reality, they were conducting espionage in China. They did not. China never, directly linked the two. The arrest of these two with Meng Wanzhou and to their release right after the deferred prosecution, they said there was no connection. Okay, well, that's nonsense. As is, that is a return in subterfuge to the we're arresting Meng Wanzhou on real charges, not as part of a political economic hostage taking.
By the way, these guys are likely really spies too. I mean, if you look at their resumes,
Right after CIA the spies. Announcement that they would be released, right after the announcement of Meng Wanzhou's release, the CSIS, the Foreign Intelligence Service of Canada, CSIS Canada, tweeted, "Welcome home, Michaels."
Your bonus check awaits.
Admit, that they were spies. They're totally not spies, completely honest, right? It's all rather laughable because, of course, we know that whenever American or British or Canadian citizens are arrested in Iran, North Korea, Russia, anywhere, China, and the accusation is that they were spies. They're totally never spies.
Missionaries.
It doesn't connect to espionage, right? So this was a tip for that. China also, by the way, right at that time, put a ban on Canadian pork and canola as part of economic retribution as well.
And ice.
Which did have serious economic impact on Canada as well. And and Canada really, really played the, radio acceptable term, the little female dog. for the United States and paid the price in the surveillance. I'm sure that they're glad they're finally over. In fact, if you'll remember, the Canadian diplomat, the Canadian ambassador to China at the time that this all happened, John McCollum, was fired by Trudeau after he made public remarks saying that this was a really bad thing Canada,
right,
and that Meng Wanzhou could make a strong case in court that this was all political and had no legal validity whatsoever. And when the Canada's own ambassador to China is saying this, Trudeau very quickly fired him. Shut up. Don't, you're not supposed to say that stuff out loud. That, of course, is not being mentioned right now either. The 15-minute memory span of the Western media. And no one is talking about, Trump's obvious blatantly obvious remarks that she would be returned if a trade deal is conducted, making, you know, the real clear reason. But after 3 years, she's finally free. These Canadian totally not spies have been freed. And, you know, this was actually, you know, the resolution of this case was on a long list of demands that China sent the United States during bilateral meetings in July, a list of 12 things that they demanded that the U.S. do before we could start retalking about trade or anything else. Now, I don't think the U.S. On there is, you know, the ending of calling Chinese media foreign agents, making them identify as foreign agents, and a number of other things that all make complete sense from the Chinese side, but I'm sure the U.S. has no intention of fulfilling all of those 12 things. But it is certainly a being seen as a victory for China, as an embarrassment and a surrender by the United States and Canada. And it's rather amusing. The Canadian state media, CBC, has put out an article on this. It's Meng Wanzhou believed to have left Canada after BC, British Columbia court drops extradition case. And it reads like boilerplate propaganda.
Yeah, 1951 or something.
A statement, Canada is a rule. This is put out by the Canadian Federal Department of Justice. Meng Wanzhou is free to leave Canada. Canada is a rule of law country. Meng Wanzhou was afforded a fair process before the courts in accordance with Canadian law. This speaks to the independence of Canada's judicial system.
Right. Eight minutes after the stip was signed in New York.
It's all that around. What it proves is that she was only ever taken hostage for the exact express wishes of the U.S., particularly right. The Trump administration and John Bolton, that she was used as, economic political hostage. When the Canadian ambassador to China said remarks, pointing to that, he was fired from his job. And she was only released when the U.S. Dropped all the charges and agreed to this deferred prosecution agreement, which consists entirely only of the statement of fact on that little deal on the PowerPoint projection.
Right.
And she has no further obligations, and all of the charges will be permanently dropped as of December of this
year. It's like getting an ACD after getting a ticket for speeding or something.
A little bit of face saving by the U.S. rather than just saying we never should have charged her at all. Right. This, deferred prosecution and this statement of fact is just admitting, as much as is humanly possible, we shouldn't have done that.
Let's be clear on something.
We don't have a stand on.
Let's be clear on something, by the way. One way of characterizing this would be that the Biden administration is undoing what the Trump administration did. But if you look at the sequence of events, that so-called I forget what the terminology they used is. There were sanctions that were imposed in the summer of 2017, about 5 months, I think, into the Trump administration against Iran and Russia and the Democratic Republic of Korea that were passed in the Congress by, I think, like a 98% vote. There were about six dissensions across the two houses of Congress. It was not only veto-proof, it was almost unanimous. And that precedes by about a year the arrest and detention of Meng Wanzhou. So, we're looking at a whole, an organic action by the government when we look at these things. The other is
bipartisan, it must be said.
Exactly. Omnipartisan. Even the independents voted for it. And
Sanctions Against Adversaries Act.
Right. That's what it's called. And the other is this. She's being prosecuted for fuzzy language in another tongue on a PowerPoint presentation that doesn't really state anything pertaining to these illegal laws on the one hand, and she's prosecuted like that. On the other hand, between 2008 and 2012, there were 400 some odd banks that failed in the United States. There was something like $1.5 trillion of money that went missing between those banks and then the investment banks that collapsed in 2008. And I would say the number of prosecutions, you would have 50 after a decimal point as a percentage of the people who were culpable and in terms of the actual assets that these things were prosecuted for. In other words, trillions of dollars were stolen because then a couple of trillion, $3 trillion was thrown at the perpetrators by us taxpayers. And no one making more than $150,000 a year was prosecuted, let alone charged with anything.
CATSA, countering America's adversaries through sanctions.
That's the one. Yeah,
that's a great economic warfare.
That was the one that told Trump Congress is making policy. You're not going to be able to undo any sanctions against anybody.
So this definitively shows how problematic the U.S. economic decoupling from China as it begins continues the Obama era military pivot against China for this coming naval conflict.
Right.
They want to fight against China in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Straits. This is the economic decoupling, not only U.S. economic decoupling, of course, but trying
EU,
to force the entirety of the West to economic decoupling with China.
Well, we got about 4 minutes, so I want to ask you a quick question, actually 3 minutes. Today, the news is that China and Australia are talking about submarines, and China and France, excuse me, about submarines, the ones that France was going to sell to Australia that the U.S. interdicted with a deal by U.S. and U.K. to do business with Australia. China's saying, hey, maybe we might want to buy some submarines. What do you see in terms of geopolitics shifting, at this moment around both of these issues, really?
I have to say that that's almost certainly a bit of trolling on China's part.
That's okay.
I very seriously doubt that France would agree to that deal. It would be definitely seen as a step too far away from NATO. And in fact, they've already said that they will continue their naval patrols off China's coast.
If you were the submarine construction union people seeing that offer, however, when France, union's going to street at a heartbeat.
Yeah, I mean, let's be clear that France, by this backstabbing deal with AUKUS, which is as much a geopolitical, far more geopolitical than a business act, but France is losing $60 billion, mm-hmm. a $60 billion industry. That is huge.
It's a lot of salaries.
For France, much bigger for France, of course, than it is for the U.S. and the U.K., but
China.
The fact that the French government had to find out about Australia dropping out of their existing contract, which it's not even clear how they're going to get out of the deal in court, right? That's what
we do have a contract. Yeah, right.
French press
rule of law.
How are you going to get out of this?
Rule of law, anyone?
But they're losing this big, huge chunk of change, and they only found out about it via social media.
Right. Somebody
it's not like
on
the US
Facebook
and UK informed their ally, France. Neither did Australia, of course. And, this is the Biden administration's big, under Jake Sullivan, the big foreign policy mantra was America is back.
Right.
We're returning to form as the leader of the free world, the hegemonic leader of the free world. And we're friends with Europe again. And they go out on this, deal with Australia, which is all about parking nuclear subs for a longer time in the South China Sea.
Right.
If Australia was to send conventional subs into the South China Sea, they could be on operation for only 11 days before having to leave and refuel. With nuclear subs, they can stay on for 77 days until they have to leave finally to get provisions for their crew. And that's what it's all about.
Wow.
In terms of the sub deal,
it's a permanent presence there. Okay, well, Mark, thank you very much. We'll catch up with you next week, and this was very interesting. interesting and educational for me, too. Thanks, bud.
Cool.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.